Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
And no matter how many times people ask me, no, I can't just give you my doorman. Of course, he's a free agent. I don't own him, but he's a great doorman, isn't he? Hi, good evening, and welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon, the podcast with more celebrities than the inauguration. I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry, but you can call me Jennifer Perry. And I want to say, first of all, thanks to everybody who's been listening and sharing with their friends. I am surprised and delightfully so when I check stats and find how many more people are subscribing and listening. And as long as you continue to do so, I can continue to bring you fantastic guests like we've had and like we have tonight and like we have coming up. A few notes from the road. Oh, and by the way, I gotta say hello out there to David Hurley, who listens every week and sends in a lot of questions. My friend Mimi and Dana in North Carolina, thank you so much. Andrea in California, and also last week we had Matt Coyle from San Diego talking about the latest book in his Detective Rick Cahill series and Blood Truth. And so check out his book, check out where you're going to find him. He was such a popular guest, such a nice guy, and such a great writer. Also, if you were listening 2 weeks ago, I had a musician, Joey Huffman, on. Now, Joey Huffman is more known as a sideman. He's been on tour several times as the keyboard player. He's one of those people that you see, but you don't know who they are. But you see him on stage with, he's been on with Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Iggy Pop. He played with Lou Reed some years back, Soul Asylum, just about anybody you can name. Lately, he's been on the road for a couple of years with Hank Williams Jr. But anyway, we had Joey on, Joey Huffman, and he was talking about, you know, being a musician, running away from home at 15 or 14 to play keyboards with the band Wild Cherry, play that funky music, White Boy. And different stories on the road. So what he's going to start doing, he was so popular on here, and this was his suggestion, and I like it. He's going to start making calls in probably about once a week from the road, because he's back on the road with Hank Williams Jr., and what he's going to do is just call in and make little short calls and give us some stories from the road of what's happening with things and people and crazy stuff that happens. So we're going to look forward to Joey Huffman calling in and live on the road with Hank Williams Jr. I'll tell you what, that's what makes this even more fun, that I can, you know, it's such a party here in Madame Perry Salon, and I'm grateful to it. Hey, tonight, a guest that's been here before, and I am thrilled to have him back here again. It's difficult to describe this person without taking up half the show, but I will say he's a cyclist, a race car driver, and thriller author, and there's some more things I'm going to bring up later that he may not know that I know. But anyway, he has got a hot new book out. And let me tell you, when I say suspense author, this man has written books. I'm a grown woman, and I can read. The first time I read one of his books, I had to, I kept thinking, where's that nightlight? I should have a nightlight in here. But I just want to say welcome once again to our friend, author Simon Wood. Simon, welcome back to Madame Perry's Salon.
Thanks for having me back.
I'm delighted. Get comfortable. And you've been here in the genie bottle before, so, you know, just find a big cushion, get comfy. And how many books have you written so far?
I'm not really sure. I think it's like 15 or so. I try not to count.
I've been posting a photo of you, and you're in the corner of a room with your book spread out, you know, coming out from you like a fanned out, and some are in other languages. And I see that you've also got a lot of audio books, and I was listening to a clip on YouTube of this week of you talking about audio books, which I would imagine those are extremely popular because there are people who drive, you know, for a living. And there are people who travel a lot, like I do, that would love audiobooks.
Yeah, I one of my things is I'm dyslexic, so I've been getting audiobooks for about 30-odd years. Mainly they were books for the blind originally from the library. But, yeah, it's been amazing how, probably especially over the last 10, 15 years, how people have used them for commuting. You know, whether it's by train or car or whatever. I know I do. I tend to have them all on my phone, and then I'll play them in the car or when I'm on a train or if I'm walking the dog or something. So I've usually got two or three stories on the go. I think the best time I've had that was I had someone sort of like live tweet me and said they were on the BART train in San Francisco listening to one of my books, and I said, I'm actually on the BART train right now. And I just asked them to put their hand up. I didn't know if they were on the train, but I just thought I just wanted them to put their hand up. And then they'd have to explain why they're putting their hand up.
That's a pretty cool story either way. But you know, yeah, you're right. It used to be anything recorded was books for the blind, you know, somebody do reading for the blind, for the blind. And then I don't know how I began to notice it when I traveled a lot, when my husband got a job in Asheville, North Carolina, and I would drive back and forth or other places where I would go. And I would just, even on XM radio, it gets to be the same thing over and over and over of stations. So I started, I noticed the truck stops would sell a lot of audio books. And then when I was, and then also in the, in another interview with you, I heard you say you were dyslexic, which that was the first time I knew that. And I thought, oh yeah, that would make it so much better or easier for people who are dyslexic. So you can enjoy the story.
Yeah. I think also, cause I grew up in the UK where you had like BBC Radio 4, which was basically like news, comedy and essentially stories. So they used to have a book at bedtime, which would be, I can't remember if it was 15 minutes or half an hour, that they would read, you know, a professional reader would basically read a book, you know, a topical book that had come out or a classic or something like that. So I was used to that. I was used to audio dramas based on books or original radio dramas that I sort of like grew up with. So when audiobooks kind of came in, it was sort of like a natural progression for me.
Yeah, that does make more sense. I listened to radio plays on Sirius XM radio, but they're the ones from back in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's the difference, you guys, with the BBC. Well, let's go straight to your newest book. Now, for anybody, any friends of mine or anybody calling that have already read it, because last week when Matt Coyle was here, there were people who said, oh, I've already read the new book. And go, don't tell me, because I'm starting on Saving Grace tonight. So I don't want anybody else telling me what's going to happen. I want to be scared to death on my own, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But so let's talk, your brand new book, Saving Grace. Tell us about it.
Basically, it's the follow-up to Paying the Piper that came out a few years ago. It takes place 6 months after the events of Paying the Piper. So the two main protagonists are Scott Fleetwood, who was a reporter for the San Francisco Independent, and an FBI agent called Tom Shields. And what happens is that they're still sort of like coming to terms with what's happened to them from the previous case of taking down the Piper. And what happens is a child is abducted, is abducted in San Francisco, and the kidnapper has two demands. He wants money, and he wants Scott Fleetwood to represent him. He's going to be the person who's going to be his middleman. And so that brings, if you like, the characters all back together. And the problem they got this time around is they've got a kidnapper who seems more interested in media headlines than in the money that he's requested.
So, yes, yeah, so it was a pay, it's a follow-up to the story of Paying the Piper, but also, when we talk about the child being on holiday, this is, so it reminds me, or similar to the story about Madeleine McCann, the girl that was
the inspiration for the book.
For people who may not know the story, would you briefly describe it to them?
Yeah, Madeleine McCann was I think she was 8 or 9 at the time. She was with her family in Portugal, and she was abducted, and this is over a decade ago now, and she still has not been found or escaped or whatever. And the scary thing is now she's going to be a teenager. She's going to be about 18, 19 now. And the thing was that was kind of an unusual story because it was the thing of it was a child in a foreign country that had been abducted. So it's that weird thing that people, you know, it's like, you know, your home country can't investigate. So you're sort of like relying on a foreign police department. So that's an added layer of complication. But there was a bunch of stuff that happened at the time, which was with some misleading news stories. There was some mischaracterization of sort of friends of the family. And it just was sort of like it became even more and more complicated than, you know, the kidnapping seemed like the almost the least of the stories towards the end. And that just kind of fascinated me. There's a lot of people who obviously did a lot of work to try and recover her. But I was very much drawn to some of the media manipulation. And I'd been following up and I'd been reading a bunch of other stories about, and this isn't to slam the media or anything, but it was just the way media can be manipulated from the inside and manipulated from the outside. And I thought, that was a good starting off point for a book.
Well, yeah, and that's true because I just finished reading Actual Malice by Gary Condit.
Oh, right.
And I don't know if you... Yeah, yeah.
I remember him, yeah.
Oh, yeah. When you start reading that, the story and all the things behind, it was that their life was a nightmare. You know, just an absolute nightmare for the whole family, as well as Chandra Levy's family, of course, but the Condit family. I mean, this was just coming, and everybody was getting involved with something crazy and story, and, you know, the media camped out by their house. It was nuts. So what made you want to go ahead and do something like a follow-up or off of Paying the Piper?
Paying the Piper is a little bit of a fan favorite with people, and I usually do things that are standalone most of the time because I tend to have, I'm driven by an idea or a concept or a premise, and I tend to then build the kinds of characters around that kind of premise. So I usually don't come back to the same people again because usually there's not a lot left of them by the end of the story. They're usually put through the ringer. But I just thought with this one that I could come back to these characters because you could see some people who'd gone through something similar already and now they're going to be punch drunk and thrown into it again. But there's almost a little bit for Scott. It's not his children on the line this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the last time a child that wasn't his responsibility was on the line, he had died. So there's, you know, there's little bits of the ghosts of the past sort of still haunting the heroes of this story. And also it's the fact that if you've survived this story that's that big, that would have been made national news, even if it's fictionally, you know, there's that problem that you become a celebrity by default. And so they've got to deal with now that they're trying to rescue a child and try to do everything, if you like, covertly or subvertly, when the whole world knows who everybody is. And so it's hard to do things out of sight when everybody knows where you live, everybody knows what you look like. Okay. So I decided that I'm going to make these characters, and I have a third book in mind for Scott and Tom.
Doubting Thomas?
No, the characters is Tom Shields, the FBI agent. I think for them, there's a third story in there for them.
Okay, got it. Tom, I see it now, FBI, Tom Shields. I know that some of your favorite writers, you liked the, you said the stories, you liked Raymond Chandler, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
You were a fan of Raymond Chandler as well as Clive King, and even Charlie Chan, Sherlock Holmes. Because I was trying to figure out some of the things you come up with. And yes, there's a lot of great authors, and I'm fortunate to have a lot of them here. But there are some things you come up with that just go from one end to the other. And I'm thinking, where does this man come up with this? In fact, there was one, it's like a short story. I remember I was reading the short story. I cannot think of the name of it now, but I remember I'm reading this book, and my husband and I were going somewhere, and finally I tell him, he goes, I said, you've got to read this story. I said, this poor guy's had the worst luck. He just parked his car somewhere, and then he gets like, he hits somebody who has a ticket, and then he goes back, and then somebody makes him do some kind of a deal, and then it goes on and on and on. Next thing you know, he thinks he's driving a dead body to some car dealership. You know what I'm talking about, Simon?
Yeah, that's a story called The Fall Guy.
The Fall Guy. And so I'm described. I said, hey, you won't believe what happens next. And my husband tells me. And I'm going, how did you know? He goes, I'm reading the same thing right now. So it was in a different book. And so it's like, I said, okay, all right. So you get out. I keep thinking, where do you come up with this? Every part of that, like you never saw it coming.
I think a couple of things is, one, The Fall Guy is based on something that happened when I was 17. I was in engineering school. One of the kids had his first car and he accidentally drove it into a car in the stall next to him. And he sort of like said, this didn't happen. And we drove off and he parked on the street. And within a couple of hours, the police came, and it was sort of, you know, it was kind of handled very well. The police officer said, you're going to pay this guy what it costs to get his car repaired. If he tells me it didn't, he goes, I'm coming back. And then he goes,
no!
Dog, and, you know. And it was sort of like a nice sort of way, but then like a year later, his car got driven into in a parking lot, and when he pulled the note off, it said, everybody thinks I'm leaving you my name and address. I'm not. And it was just kind of that sort of thing of, oh, I kind of like the karma of that. But there's that kind of thing of, there's two things. There's that one thing in life where you think you can get away with it and you can't. And two, you don't know who the other person is that you impact. And that could be anybody from the nicest, mildest person. It could be the Dalai Lama you parked into, or it's going to be, it's going to be Genghis Khan you've just drove into. And so the story that could play out from that can change dramatically. But the other side of that, I think, is my background is engineering. I used to design safety systems for oil rigs and things, and you had to think around corners. You had to think about how people can screw up, because it's that thing of like, what if someone doesn't pull this valve or turn this wheel or shut this off, or they forget to fill this up, or they don't check that light's gone out. And you sort of like say, well, this will think for them. If they do this, then this is a backup. And for that backup, there's another backup. And so I'm just used to just looking at a situation and going, this can go wrong 10 ways from Sunday if you make a left turn now. But if you make a right turn, this is what potentially will go wrong. And so most of it is just thinking recklessly about what are the impacts of any given decision.
So then, suffice it to say, it seems to me like engineering work, because my husband's an engineer, it really does teach you to think of different, it creates a pattern of, I guess, brain work or brain activity or skill, the way you could think of, as you said, things that could go wrong several different ways. And
yeah,
people can
I think, you know, they sort of like talk about levels of safety, and it's like, how many times can someone do the, you know, override your safety systems before it really does go wrong? But also, you know, I learned to fly, and part of flying, you know, half the time to fly is relatively easy. To navigate and deal with issues is the trickier part. I mean, most of your training is what if it all goes wrong, but even from the smallest airplane is designed very cleverly that, you know, for every mechanical system, there's an electrical system. For every electrical system, there's something else. So it's like if one thing goes wrong, you've got something else that you can rely on to take up the job of that failed gauge. And so I kind of like that, because that sort of, you know, tries to cover for all the eventualities. Because you can almost get to the point that all your gauges are out, but there's maybe like one or two things that are in a plane that would save your life, and that would allow you still to get where you need to go, and that's really clever thinking on the part of aircraft designers, I think, pretty much from World War II onwards.
Well, and as someone who doesn't know how to fly, but as a passenger, that's really good to know. No idea. And by the way, if you're listening live tonight with us on May the 8th, you can call in and talk to Simon Wood. The number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922. Blog Talk Radio assures me it's a toll-free call in the U.S. I just want to read a couple of quotes from people who is those excerpts from their review of your newest book, Saving Grace. One of them is D.M. Pulley, author of The Unclaimed Victim. He says, Simon Wood grabs you by the throat on page one and takes you on a wild thrill ride, a nail biter from start to finish. And, Robert Dagoni, he is the author of My Sister's Grave. He says, nail-biting suspense and a high-stakes thriller. Simon Wood's gift is a dizzying pace packed with twists and turns to the very last enjoyable word. Those are nice. How does it feel to when other writers see you in such a
way? I'm always slightly embarrassed, and I try to ignore them.
All right. Sorry I brought it up.
No, it's always weird. It's like, you know, someone's holding your homework up in school and telling everybody what a great job you did. It's nice, but it's hard. I think it's an English thing. We don't know how to deal with compliments.
I think there are a lot of places like that. No, I guess English, or I know when I was in Japan, they would tell me, you know, we don't brag about our kids like people do in America when we went there. And so maybe that's the modesty. It's very modest. I also know, I listened to an interview where you said somebody was asking you about voices when you about your audiobooks, and they said, well, when you think of your books and your main characters, what do their voices sound like to you? And you said, well, they all sound like me. You know, being with an accent of yours. But if you, because, you know, the Fleetwood and Chills series, if you were casting this for a film, if you were, and maybe you are going to do a film, I don't know, but if you do, and you had some say on casting, who do you see as Fleetwood?
Oh, for Saving Grace?
Yeah.
The two people I had in mind at the time, because we've got actually film interest on one of the other books, and you know, people were put in places as the playing parts in the film of sort of like changes monthly. So, but for me, I think I would actually be interested in seeing sort of like Ryan Reynolds as Scott. I'm not sure who I'd want to be Tom Shields, but I've always sort of seen Hugh Jackman or Ryan Reynolds as Scott Fleetwood.
Those are good choices. I like that.
I think they'd both be very good at showing panic and fear about when everything's going wrong.
Okay, good. Yeah, that was what I was asking. What was it about their work that makes you see them in that position or see them in those roles? And yeah, that's a very good answer too.
Yeah, I think it's just, I think they'd be able to give the right reaction.
Good. Yeah, I could see that. I don't want to ask you too much about the film because I don't want to, you know, throw any kind of a jinx or anything to it, but that sounds pretty good. You know, you can make it here in Atlanta because we've got a lot of films going on right now.
There's probably a good chance that that's where it would be made.
Really?
Yeah, the film company does an awful lot of film in Atlanta, so my feeling is that probably the majority of it will probably end. If they follow through with it and it goes the full distance, then I can see it being filmed in Atlanta.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be good. Then you'd have to bring Julie with you, and then, you know, and all your fan club can meet you here. Yeah, last week I worked on Haunting of Hill House, which is a Netflix series where I played a funeral home director at a convention.
Okay.
And the thing is, and I'm out in the suburbs. I was born and raised in Atlanta, but I'm out in the suburbs, Simon. And so I get this email from the casting people saying, we need for you to have this, this, and this. They give me 2 days. We need for you to have this kind of outfit and this kind of colors and this so forth. So I'm trying to head to the store to get it. And there's all these shopping centers blocked off, strip malls, with all these trailers and trucks. And I'm going, what's happening here? And then somebody goes, oh, Mark Wahlberg's over there, you know, filming some scenes for a film. Well, tell him to hurry it up because I've got to go get something too, you know. But, yeah, you never – in Atlanta, you never know who's around, you know, with film. So, yeah, this would be a great place to do it. Lots of tax breaks for film and television people. That would be fun. Is this the first book that you've, you know, come this close to seeing in film?
I think this is the one that's got the furthest to the point where – there's been screenplays and stuff. I've had maybe 4 or 5 other attempts, but they've never really gone the whole hog. I think there's, you know, there's more the chance of, you know, there's like dozens, you know, thousands and thousands of books written every year, but there's only about 200 movies made a year. So, you know, your percentages are quite low of getting the full conversion all the way through. The most interesting one, I think, was a Korean film company wanted to do Paying the Piper in Korea and change it to a Korean location and be a Korean language film. And I think that would have been really fun to see what they would have done with it. But the producer and the writer couldn't get their finances up for it. But that would have been fun. I would have liked to have seen how that would have turned out.
You know, I hear a lot of authors talk about making their own small or short films or independent films, whether they, you know, get to an IndieFest or a GoFundMe or something to make as a way, because distribution is on an indie film is easier than it was, you know, some 10 years ago. Just to get out in the market and show their work. Have you ever thought about doing that, or has anyone ever suggested that to you?
They tried to do a web series based on one of my short stories, but that didn't quite work out. But I haven't myself, just because deals or the resources to sort of do something like that at this stage. If I had someone to partner up with, then I think it would become a lot easier. But at this point, I honestly wouldn't know where to start.
Mm-hmm. So a web series, yeah, those are quite popular too. What about, now you've got my mind picturing a web series for Paying the Piper, and that would be pretty interesting too. Or what about a television series? Do you see
I've seen potentially for a couple of my books, I think there's potential of taking that character and making it episodic. I think no show would work in that context. And also The One That Got Away, I think there's potential for The One That Got Away, I could see that being more TV movie kind of deal. Whereas I could see no show being the character from that could be more of an episodic, 10-episode, 12-episode kind of TV show.
Yeah, I like that. When, but that would be fun, don't you think? Like that?
Yeah, I think for me, it opens it up to a different audience. It's a chance to play with a different kind of medium. Part of my, if you like, bucket list for writing is that I would still like to get something on Radio 4 as a radio play, and I'd like to do a comic. At the same time, I still would like to see, a TV show or a movie made, because you've got, the way you do it as a book is completely different, the way of conveying the same thing in a visual medium.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned comic book, because that's gotten so popular. And the last time I was at Book Expo America, 2 years ago, there seemed to be, not exactly a preponderance, but you could tell it was starting to emerge more. And also Andrew Aiden and I forget his partner's name, but they worked with Congressman John Lewis, who's...
Yes, I've seen those. I've seen those comic books.
Yeah, because I think about 4 or 5 years ago, John Lewis was at Book Expo in New York and gave out, sample one chapter. And then when I went to see John Lewis somewhere in Atlanta last summer, Andrew Aiden said, Lewis is trying to talk about how to reach young people, tell young people about the civil rights movement, about history and so forth. How can I reach them? And they're going, well, you could do the graphic novel, you could do a comic book. And he's going, yeah. And they kept on every time they said, we got to reach people. Well, you could do this. And I think it took them a couple of years to convince him. And then it's been, extremely popular. I've got two in the series. And that, I'm just very interested to hear you say that, because, that is so popular now.
Yeah, it's just trying to convey, you're trying to convey a story through images, and you're having to pick the best images that you can to do that. Because, you know, whereas I might write 100,000 words for, a novel, you know, I'm going to be limited to maybe a couple of hundred panels to tell that story, mm-hmm. same story. And so, you know, you've got to convey multiple things at once and be clever about the way you're going to tell it. The fewer words you have to use to tell a story, the harder it gets.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, good point. On a different, just a little bit different subject, I noticed, too, that you also, and this is so people who are interested can contact you from your website about it. And by the way, I like how you call your website, it's like your web hangout or hideout, your web hideout.
Yeah.
But and if you're listening, it's simonwood.net. But you are available, so a lot of people know, but people listening who want to know may not be aware, that you are available as a keynote speaker or to hold workshops. I see that you've got one coming up in September at the Southeast, where is this one at? Southeast Washington Writers Southwest, yeah. That's Ben. And you're going to be, it says keynote speaker and plotting workshop. I can't think of anybody better than you for a plotting workshop. So what do you teach people in there? What do you do without giving away everything?
Basically, for the plotting one, I do a few different ones. Some I do online with people with videos that I've done. But if I'm doing in person, what I tend to do is I wrote things for Writer's Digest a few years ago, and that, you know, every one of those is a great basis for a workshop. But I tend to break things down into very simple pieces, and again, it's probably my little engineering background, but I'll take the subject, whether, you know, in this case, plotting, and go, this is how I construct a story. This is how I literally, like Lego blocks, this is how I put it together. And this is how it holds up. This is how it self-supports itself. And I just sort of take people through mainly a thought process of how you can, you know, there's something daunting about a book and you're like, say, I've got to write 300 pages and I've got to make it all fit and I've got to make it all work. And it seems such a huge task. And I just break it down into component pieces and say, you just take it one scene at a time, but just know where all your scenes are. And so I have a spreadsheet and color coding, and it's all on one page. And it just makes, it takes some of the fear and the sort of like unknown out of writing a book. It still is not easy, but I take some of the pitfalls and perils of starting without, you know, without a clue and just trying to plow through.
I like some of the titles of your workshops, Plot Thickeners and Killer Suspense.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what people want. So you probably enjoy doing that, I could imagine, because I think that as an engineer, I know my husband, he likes to explain things, and he doesn't mansplain. You know, I've seen him explain things without talking down to people, and I could imagine you'd be the same way. You would explain things on where people understand it and make it fun.
Yeah, I try to. There's a little bit of public speaking is probably something that I wouldn't have said I would do on a regular basis, but it's something I didn't really have a choice. If I was going to write books, I had to, if you like, face the public, and I had to learn a way of engaging the audience. And that sort of like helped me when it comes to doing the workshops. But there's always a little bit of fear in the back of my head that I'm in front of an audience, and I think that helps keep things animated. That I'm trying to just bottle the fear while I'm doing it.
It gives you energy. That's what Ron Howard says. If you're a little nervous, it gives you energy. Yeah, because that's easy for him to say. I know.
Yeah, there's no kind of motivator like fear.
So, one more thing, and I don't know if you keep this available for the public or not, but you have your own family brand of honey?
Yes, yeah. My wife is a scientist by training, and a few years ago, we used to have a huge bottle brush tree in our backyard at our old house that in the summer just hummed with bees. And then one year we just didn't get any. And so my wife said, I just want to have a beehive so that the bottle brush tree and the trees around will have something to pollinate them and stuff. And so we just, we kind of learned off the cuff how to be beekeepers, and it worked. But the side effect was, in the first year that we established a hive, we had about 27 pounds of honey, and we went, there's no way we're going through this. So we started just jarring it and selling it, and then people kind of liked it, and we expanded, and we have 3 hives, and they produce about 70 or 80 pounds of honey a year. So we have our own honey brand, our own honey label. We sell to some stores, but most of it we sell direct, because as soon as we get any kind of harvest, it's within about 24 hours it's sold out from our customer base. So it doesn't stick around long.
Wildcat Canyon.
Yeah. That's where we kind of butt up against where we live.
I can see, you know, this would be a great thing to sell when you're having public appearances. You could have a gift basket that's got a couple of books, maybe an audio book, and some honey in there. Wrap it up, put a bow on it, jack up the price, and you've got, you know, somebody forgets a gift to take home. Or somebody needs something for, you know, Mother's Day or whatever, that'd be perfect.
Yeah, I don't think some of our honey customers would like us diverting traffic away from them.
Okay.
But yeah, it's an idea.
Okay, all right. Maybe not my best, but, you know, I'm always... You know, I'm a publicist, too, so I'm always thinking about what else could you do? Ready-made gifts.
Well,
or actually,
what it is with our customers, one thing we didn't know we'd end up with is everybody with allergies. And so that's why we don't virtually sell to stores anymore, because it's just people with allergies who are looking for local honey to help with their issues. And, you know, so it does look a little bit shady when people come to our house with red eyes, sniffing and twitching, and then they come in and then they leave with something and they seem very happy. So yeah, I'm waiting for the cops to be called on us.
You know, we talked a couple of years ago, you and I talked about, you said if anything happened, you know, your browser history.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's even a Patricia Highsmith story where a writer is trying to see how things would work. He rolls up some carpet, goes and buries it in the wood so he could be able to write it better. And then his wife takes off, disappears, and everybody knows they see him carry this thing out and burying it. And you were saying, you know, if anything happened, somebody got a hold of your browser history, if Julie decided just to go on a little girl's vacation and not tell you, you've got all kind of stuff on there.
Yeah, and it is that thing of that I tend to be one of those people who does try stuff out. You know, it's like I will, you know, walk my crime scenes. I will try and learn how to use whatever tools are being used in the story. So, yeah, it does look a bit worse that I've got in browser history and probably receipts for things that would all make a story to a police officer if they ever came by.
Yeah, I laugh now, right? So, anyway. Well, Simon, it's been so good having you here, and I'm out of time, but I just want to thank you so much, and I do hope you'll come back, and I wish you much success and saving grace and everything you have coming up. So if you're listening, folks, trust me. If you don't trust me, trust my husband. Once you start reading Simon Wood's books, you'll be hooked. You'll be scared, but you'll be hooked. And Simon, can you think of a better way to put it than that?
No.
Well, you probably can, but you'll be that size. So Saving Grace, you can get it on Amazon. They can get and they can get autographed books from you. Or I saw that you would also autograph a book plate if people need it. They already have a book.
Yeah, and I can autograph ebooks now as well. There's a little service that allows me to sign an ebook and it comes back to your ebook.
Nice. Okay. Well, I just want to say, folks, I'll have Saving Grace. I'll have the website, simonwood.net, and he's on all the social media, and I will be sharing links to get Simon's books on all of my social media as well. So if you're looking around for it, I have it all out there for you. And Simon, it's great to have you. Please come back. Much success.